He's right. You're wrong. Get used to it.
Leave me alone.
Mr. Tall, Dark, and Cranky.
Bite me.
Here's Bob McCowan on Toronto's Sports Radio. The Fan 590.
Nurses all gathered round, and they gazed in wide wonder at the joy they had found. The head nurse spoke up, said, "Leave this one alone." She could tell right away that I was bad to the bone, bad to the bone, bad to the bone, bad.
Bad. 2 minutes after 3 o'clock on the Fan. How you doing? It's Tuesday, July the 27th, 2010. The radio program's on the air. A bright, sunny day here in the Big Smoke. Bob McCown, captain's chair. Kicking ass, taking names. Long list of people. Long list of people. Very busy show today. Jack Armstrong will join us momentarily. Brian Colangelo on this radio program last night had some intriguing thoughts about Chris Bosch, his departure, and... while he was careful in choosing his words, clearly let it be known that he thought Chris Bosch had checked out of the hotel reality while he was still a member of the Toronto Blue Jays. In fact, he thought circa the All-Star break, citing as at least one example, the ankle injury that caused Bosch to miss 6 or 7 games, in the view of the... Raptor doctors, Bosch could have played, but effectively chose not to. It was sort of a backhanded criticism, and Colangelo tried not to make too much of it, but it was what it was. Jack Armstrong will join us in a minute. Darren Revelle of CNBC will be with us. The future of the Baseball Hall of Fame in some doubt with the effects of the steroid era hitting Cooperstown. Sid Ziegler is with Outsports.com. A new study shows soccer players would accept gay teammates. Well, good for them. It's still sad that it's a story that others would not. But I guess I have to concede that there must be something to that, given the fact that we have yet to see an active major professional athlete out himself. Kevin McGrath of the Toronto Star, what up with Thomas Caberle and that trade talk? Bob Elliott of The Sun, Jared Bell of USA Today, Wayne Parrish, now of Post Media Network, and Keith Law of ESPN, all coming up. John Channon will join us in a bit. But first, here's our friend Jack Armstrong of TSN and The Fan. Hello, Jack.
Bob, how are you?
I'm well, Coach. Did you happen to hear Colangelo on the program last night?
Yes, I did.
What do you make of his what he said about Bosch? My initial reaction was, my ears perked up. I raised a Spockian eyebrow as he was talking, and then in an attempt to get him to perhaps... clarify what he had said, or perhaps even go further, it seemed he attempted to backtrack a little bit. Do you think he called Chris Bosch out?
Oh, no doubt. I was shocked, quite frankly, knowing Brian and knowing how guarded he is and how, I guess the word would be very, he's a guy that, very calculated in what he does. And for him to lay those comments on the audience yesterday, there's definitely intent there. And, quite frankly, I was very surprised that he would use not only your form or any form to say those things, because, you look at what Daniel Gilbert did, the owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers, and the comments that he made about LeBron James. And we all know that LeBron, when it's all said and done, handled it the wrong way in terms of his announcement of leaving for Miami. And he's an independent contractor, and he's entitled, based upon the collective bargaining agreement, to do whatever he wants. But to have a press conference in Greenwich, Connecticut, and really stick it in the face of the folks in Cleveland, was wrong. He should have given the Cavs a little bit more respect and all that. But at the end of the day, I don't think Daniel Gilbert handled it all that well either. If, in fact, you know, LeBron went to Greenwich and said he was coming back, and I don't think any of the things that he said about LeBron would have ever been heard. And, you know, when I heard Brian yesterday, I was kind of surprised that a guy that they quote-unquote were calling a partner, if in fact they were going to do a sign-and-trade, if he didn't come back, suddenly would be portrayed in a different light, you know, in the aftermath of it. So I was a little bit surprised by it because I think it's something that agents and players, when they hear comments like that, you know, you raise a Spocky and I think players and agents raise that same thing now that they say, well, wait a minute, you know, I leave a market and now my character is going to be trashed. So I was definitely surprised.
Oh, sorry, Jack, I had my microphone off. Do you believe that this was Brian's almost inevitable response to the criticism he has received publicly for the way the Bosch scenario unfolded? The fact that Chris wound up leaving?
Bob, I wouldn't be surprised at that. You know, there's definitely a reaction there, and he's come under some severe heat. You know, obviously, Chris Bosch was drafted by Glenn Grunwald and was here with Rob Babcock. And then when Brian came in, you know, Chris Bosch and Jose Calderon at the end of the rainbow were the only two guys left from the Grunwald / Babcock era. And now, you know, the guy that was, you know, conceivably the guy that you were trying to build around walks out. You know, I think there's always going to be criticism directed at the player based upon the fact that they only went to two playoffs and didn't get out of the first round. At the same time, the criticism is going to be directed at the teammates and the coaches and as well as the guy making the decision. So it's obviously a natural response to say that, you know, we tried to provide him with teammates that it would work with, and at the same time, it didn't work. But at the end of the day, I think if you look at Chris Bosh, you know, I don't know. I look at it for 7 years and being around Chris every day, on the whole. Now, I'm not going to say every day, but on the whole, I thought he did a pretty damn good job. I thought he was a pretty damn good player. And, you know, when you start questioning a guy's pain tolerance, you know when a guy is in the final year of his contract that he's going to err on the side of caution if there's an injury issue. You know that going in as a quote-unquote partner with that guy that you might want to keep or you might want to do a sign and trade with. So you got to live with those circumstances that come into play. And, you know, it's kind of disappointing now to question a guy's pain tolerance when, in fact, over the course of the long haul, I thought he gave everything he had on a day-to-day basis when he was here.
I thought that what the picture that Colangelo was subtly trying to paint was one effectively of a collusionary act on the part of Wade, James, and Bosch to the point where he may have even said, but certainly alluded to the fact that the three of them may have hatched this, or at least maybe it was hatched before that, but confirmed with their intent during the All-Star break, and that may have had an impact on Chris Bosh allegedly shutting down for the second half of the season, at least mentally.
Well, that very well could have been the case. But when you look at you know, Dwayne Wade and you look at LeBron James, even though LeBron had a poor performance in the playoffs in the final few games, I don't think you could say the same thing about those guys. And quite frankly, when Chris was healthy, even though the numbers were a little less than what we've seen, I would say they were still very, very good. And was the problem with the team a matter of him, or was it a matter of the other guys around him? And, you know, again, when you go into a final year of a deal with a guy and you know that Dwayne Wade and LeBron James are teammates, are free agents as well, and the issue from a representation standpoint with agents, and you know all the dynamics that are in play there and all the possibilities that exist, you go in with eyes totally wide open to all those possibilities, and that's the risk you take. And if you decide to take that risk, those are the issues that come with it that you have to handle based upon the players that are teammates of that player and how the coaching staff handles the issues as well.
With Jack Armstrong. Colangelo also acknowledged that he's nowhere near done trying to deal. He says he's got a bunch of irons in the fire and has no idea whether things will unfold. And as you know, his track record this summer is mediocre at best. And having had two transactions, two players that they wanted to acquire, those deals fall through. And those maybe not situations where Brian can be held accountable for or responsible for, at least not singularly. But nonetheless, those are, well, for lack of a better term, embarrassing moments. You know, to lose Chris Bosch and get effectively nothing in return, to have two deals that are announced that don't materialize with a team that has the fragility that this one does right now, these are not positive steps. Would you not concede?
No, I would agree with that. But in defense of Brian, they were not announced by the Toronto Raptors. They weren't announced by any NBA team. They were, quite frankly, leaked by players with their Twitter accounts and obviously the media doing their job. And they have no knock on the media for doing it. They're doing what they're supposed to do. They report it, and it becomes fact. So, a deal's not a deal until a deal's done. So, there's so many other deals that are close to taking place that fall apart at the last second that we never find out about. But in this world of instantaneous information, it's a matter of now. It takes on a new meaning. It becomes factual before it really the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. So, yeah, fans take issue with Brian for those types of deals falling apart. But at the end of the day, they weren't deals yet. So I give him credit for trying to get deals that, quite frankly, would have improved the ball club, short and long term, that unfortunately didn't take place. And at the end of the day, I still go back to the issue with Bosch and the comments that, when you guys were on together yesterday. And, I even look at the connection, Bob, of Jerry Colangelo, Brian's dad, and Mike Krzyzewski, the coach of USA Basketball. And quite frankly, I'm not sure if Mike Krzyzewski would say those same things about Chris Bosch. And, I'm just blown. I was blown away by it. I really was. And again, Chris Bosch by no means is perfect and by no means is in the same category as a Kobe Bryant or a Michael Jordan or anything like that. I mean, he's a very, very good player, an excellent player, but by no means that number one star guy. But a guy I thought that had a really good run in Toronto. And at the end of the day, he's an independent contractor, and he made a decision to leave, and he had every right to make that decision. And you can debate whether it was because he was shutting it down late or whether he was being cautious or even the Raptors were being cautious, because if he's going to leave and you want to do a sign and trade, you don't want a guy that's going to be out on the market that is a distressed asset. So you want to make sure, as much as he wants to be healthy, you want him healthy as well for your chance to win and your chance to be part of a trade in a sign and trade that benefits you, because he's at his full value.
Jack, always a pleasure. Thanks, pal.
Bob, my pleasure. Have a good night.
You too. Jack Armstrong from, of course, The Fan and TSN. Our business editor, Darren Revell, joins us next when Primetime Sports continues. This is The Fan.
Toronto FC versus CD Montagua tonight at 8 on fan590.com. Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Toronto Sports Radio, The Fan 590.
Minutes after 3 o'clock on The Fan. I'm coming in here. John Shannon will join me at the top of the hour. Sid Ziegler of Outsports.com. Kevin McGrann from The Star. Bob Elliott of The Sun. Jared Bell, USA Today. Wayne Parrish, now the, he's still the head of Canada Basketball, but now with Post Media Network. Keith Law of ESPN, all coming up on the show. He's one of our favorites, our business editor, Darren Revell of CNBC. Hello, Revell. How are you?
I'm doing very well. We don't usually talk this early, but I can still go,
No, I know. Well, I'm usually not on this early, but they changed my time, so Now we're back an hour from where it used to be. Yeah.
Anytime for you.
Yeah, you're a pal. Andre Dawson, Doug Harvey, Whitey Herzog, all induced into the Baseball Hall of Fame. and all worthy of, in my opinion. The Hawk was a superlative athlete who in many ways reminds me of Bobby Orr. Like, how good could he have been if he had half-assed decent knees? Whitey Herzog, a legendary manager. Doug Harvey, of course, the umpire. Things are not all rosy in Cooperstown with the Baseball Hall of Fame. Attendance is down, revenues are down, and at least in part, it's because while this may be a worthy group, it's not a star-struck group.
And will that ever occur in the near future? I mean, that's the problem.
Yeah.
I don't know what Jeff Idelson, the president of the Hall of Fame, really should say. He's in the position of Gary Bettman often, which is being a cheerleader and at the same time having trouble publicly mentioning what reality is. There's a down year, they say, oh, it's the last 2 years, it's the economy, it's the bad weather in the Northeast. Listen, the bottom line is the Hall of Fame is not what it once was and might not ever be what it once was. Before last year, it was 12 years before 300,000 people failed to come through the Hall of Fame. This, it'd probably be less than 300,000 people this year as well. And for the foreseeable future. I mean, Rafael Palmeiro is not getting inducted next year. We know that. Mike Piazza is going to have to save the class of 2013 from Clemens and Sosa and Bonds. And, you know, who knows about Jeff Bagwell? Will Craig Biggio bring the masses? Will Roberto Alomar bring the masses? What is it going to take? Are they going to have to extend the veterans whose eligibility expired a little bit more to get more people in? What's going to happen? The bottom line is that Hall of Fame has been losing money. They're not going to go out of business because there's going to be people supporting them. But at the same time, it's not good.
All right, let's take a couple of minutes and try and analyze between the two of us what you do if you're running the Baseball Hall of Fame. For those that have not been there, Cooperstown is, bluntly, it's on the road to nowhere. It is in the middle of New York. It is not on a major highway. It is...
it's hard getting in and harder getting out.
Well, you don't go to Cooperstown by accident. You go,
yeah, it's,
you know,
four hours from everywhere, basically.
Well,
New York, Philadelphia, Boston, and that's one of the problems. You know,
well, and
I
mean, it's not on a major interstate, even. It's not on 88. It's not on 90. It's stuck in the middle.
And the thing is, it's a little bit more than from those big cities than a quick drive over. I mean, I don't know about you, but once I hit 3 hours, I'm about done. Not unless I'm within a not to see something that's static and that I could see any time if I were in that area. If maybe it's a college football game, I'll drive, but certainly not for a Hall of Fame.
So, is one of the issues Cooperstown? And I understand the historical designation, but would this museum have a greater chance of success if it was in a major metropolis, let's say, or even someplace more convenient?
It would probably be a little bit more steady, but it would still be, in relation to previous numbers, uncomfortably down as it is now.
So you believe this is a function, at least in part, of an unflattering group over the last couple of years. But it is also, I think, a cyclical, a function of the time in which we live. I mean, I am of an age where I have children and now young grandchildren even. And I certainly know with my kids that their attachment in a sporting sense to history before them is virtually non-existent. And the current generation, I dare say, has neither the time nor the inclination to look backwards. They're too busy looking forwards. And maybe that may be a good thing. But, the days of making sure I didn't miss the All-Star game because it may have been my only chance to see Willie Mays play center field are long gone now. And maybe you can never bring the Hall of Fame back. Maybe the next generation won't look at it the way we did.
It's hard. I mean, here's the main thing about the main problem I have is that, what do you do? What do you do now, Bob? I mean, do you let some of these guys back in and you put an asterisk in? I've been told that, you know, good luck, and I'm not trying to name specific people, but good luck to get, Willie Mays, anyone on the Ernie Banks, anyone on that stage, you know, good luck to get those people on the stage if they let some of those people back in. And that's going to be a problem, too.
Yeah, I'm inclined to suggest, I don't even know if I even believe this, Darren, but I'm inclined to suggest that it may take another generation for there to be a cleansing and forgiveness of this steroid era. But I don't think it's going to happen with those of us that experienced it.
No, and maybe that's why there's a big gap. You know, that maybe that's why we're going to have some 6 or 7 uncomfortable years until we can clean out all the Hall of Famers that would have been Roger Clemens or and the gaping hole is what makes it so tough, because what are they to do? What, you know, we got to get to a clean era now. And it seems like the writers are not letting these guys in. And so what's going to happen? How many more years are you going to be able to take a Roberto Alomar or a Craig Biggio or a, you know, is Tim Salmon in Hall of Famer? I don't know. I look at these lists and I used to laugh at, you know, that's funny. That guy's not even borderline. And what do you do? Are they going to have, I think they've had like a couple years where no one's been inducted. Are they going to have a writer and an umpire 1 year?
Yeah. Well, and I've always had the respect I've always had for the Baseball Hall of Fame has been their steadfast exclusionary attitude, which is to say, you don't get in this unless you were really great. And you can make arguments that, on a lot of players as to whether they were really great. But nonetheless, by comparison to the other Halls of Fame, the baseball one, in my mind, always stood at the top of the heap. And now I wonder, is there going to be pressure to ensure that there is an inductee every year or two or three?
That's the question. And financially, they'll be okay, even though if they lose money, because they'll get the backing of the Hall of Fame. But, you know, otherwise, you know, will they do it just to do it? I would say not, but sometimes the Hall of Fame in attendance is based on a 6 to 8% of what happens on Hall of Fame induction weekend. So we have zero people coming, and you say, imagine if they said, we're not inducting anyone this year.
Well, it's all, you know, you're almost in this, and I mean, can the Hall of Fame even manipulate its own entry without adjusting the numbers? I mean, you can't manipulate how the writers vote. So you can't even control that.
Right, exactly.
And so you in effect, you probably face a downward spiral on no matter what you do. There's a greater risk that there'll be nobody inducted over the next couple of years than there is of a bunch of guys getting inducted. Far greater chance.
And I agree.
And that's
not
what you want. Speaking of that, with the recent passing of George Steinbrenner, you and I haven't chatted since then, and we're talking about the Hall of Fame. You know, almost immediately, people started opining about, well, would you put Steinbrenner in the Hall of Fame? And, well, would you? It's not easy,
is
it?
It's a tough one. He was banned from the sport twice.
Yeah.
How do you not? I think he can go on either side, you know? Would you?
I don't have the answer either. I have the same response you did, and that is, you know, deep breath and think. It's not, I don't have an automatic yes or no. I mean, look at
Marvin Miller in the Hall of Fame.
Well, Marvin Miller should have been in there, but I mean, this is not a contest between Marvin Miller and George Steinbrenner. Here's what I would say. I would say that George Steinbrenner, for lack of a better term, was more infamous than famous, that he was a high-profile individual, but his contributions to the game itself, I have a hard time figuring out what those would be. How's that?
Fair.
You know,
yeah,
and
it's fair.
You know, and certainly there was no one more famous than George Steinbrenner. There was no one more famous as a player than George Steinbrenner at his height of outrageousness. He was more quoted than any player, more quoted than any president, general manager, or anybody else. He was as high a profile on the get list on this show as you can possibly get. And when we got him, we were shocked and ecstatic. So, but is that a Hall of Fame guy? You know,
maybe not. No, I don't. Maybe not. You know,
that's the difficult part of it, isn't it?
Yep.
And when does Marvin Miller get in? If ever?
Maybe never. Maybe never. He's not going to drive the masses, though, to the Hall of Fame.
Well, and again, are you getting close to the point where there are an increasing number of people with hands on the ballot who know Marvin Miller only by what they've read in books?
Right, that's true as well.
And that makes it much more difficult, doesn't it?
It does. I think the only solving of the not letting the performance-enhancing drug guys in and still drawing crowds is to, you know, extend or maybe open up the older guys who didn't get in. But they didn't get in. I mean,
no, that's right.
What, it's very uncomfortable. I'm not saying it isn't, but I think there would be crowds for, you know, a Thurman Munson or something like that.
Would you let Pete Rose in?
I've always wanted to let Pete Rose in.
I have too. Not condoning what he was found to have done, but again, just straight up baseball. Who was better?
Guy doesn't amass the statistics.
No.
It's his stats. Just show me the stats.
Yeah, and there's no evidence that he threw a baseball game.
No, absolutely not.
I mean, he bet on baseball games.
He did.
But there's no evidence he ever bet against his own team.
That's true.
And the unfortunate part is there are too many people out there that don't understand gaming.
There is some sort of sketchiness about whether he'd pull a pitcher based on information, you know, for so that he could win another game or something like that at a certain point.
It
could be argued it affected his managing. But he didn't. There's no evidence that he said, "Okay, let's throw this guy out here just so he loses."
Yeah, and I've never seen evidence that implicitly suggested that he did anything untoward, even as a manager in that regard.
Right.
I mean, I think this is people, organizing a witch hunt and looking for justification for booting him out, and that's where he is. And maybe that's the next step. Let Pete Rose in, because I'll tell you what, you'd break attendance records for that one.
That would happen. Oh, well, Pete Rose sat and signed everything in the world. I mean,
it's not like
anyone needs anything signed anymore.
No. Ravel, we got to get out of here right at
time. All right, be good.
Nice to talk to you. Darren Ravel of CNBC. We'll come back with more. Primetime will continue in a moment on The Fan Toronto.
Blue Jays baseball, Jays and Orioles, tonight at 7. Now, more of Bob McCowan and Primetime Sports on Toronto Sports Radio, The Fan 590.
A recent story suggests that a survey of 2,000 soccer fans in Britain found that only 7% of them believed that soccer had no place for homosexuals. It was conducted by culture, media, and sport professor Ellis Cashmore. And he says, the big surprise was that we got what you'd call a counterintuitive response. And that was that 93% felt that there was no place for homophobia in soccer, or football, if you will, in Britain. And it should be stomped out, and they felt it brought shame on football. There was a call for greater transparency. A lot of people thought they would prefer it if gay footballers came out because they don't think they'd have to put up with that much abuse, unquote. Well, the truth is it's easy for anybody to say that they wouldn't put up with much abuse. And I certainly am in no position to offer a definitive statement on it, except to say that I certainly wouldn't want to be the first. Having said that, for better than 20 years on this program, we periodically identified this situation and tried to figure out when it was going to be that the first active gay athlete in a major team sport would come out. And the answer is, we're still waiting. What we have seen in increasing numbers, not overwhelming numbers, but in increasing numbers, is gay athletes coming out shortly after they retire. as if there is some greater comfort zone, comfort level in that process, to be out of the public eye, out of the out of reach of those that might want to do you any harm. And I'm not necessarily talking about physical harm, but mental harm, if you will. And maybe that's the next step to gay athletes being comfortable in announcing their sexuality while they're still in uniform. And yet we continue to wait. Sid Ziegler's with OutSports.com. It is a website for predominantly for and about gay athletes. Hi, Sid. How are you?
I'm running through a train station, but I'm fantastic.
Good of you to take time for us. This what do you think this really means? This notation for this survey done by British soccer fans that showed 93% felt there was no place for homophobia. Should we be surprised at that, or is my sense sort of is, well, that seems like about right.
Well, every single poll taken over the last 10 years in Europe or the United States or Canada says that a majority and a vast majority of sports fans don't care if their favorite player is gay.
Right.
Don't care if a member of their favorite team is gay. They don't care. And so this is not remotely a surprise. In fact, a poll done 2 years ago, either by ESPN or Sports Illustrated, said that a majority of players in the NFL and the NBA and Major League Baseball and the NHL all had no problem with having a gay teammate. Yet for some reason, the media continues to portray the sports world as homophobic. They continue to focus on the minority of people who say homophobic things and do homophobic things, and they just don't talk about the people who are incredibly gay positive, and the fact that most people just don't care about this issue anymore.
Yeah, and having said that, I don't think you were with me at the top. I've been doing this program 35 years, and at least 20 in the last 20 years, we've I wouldn't necessarily say on a regular basis, but more than a few times, have addressed this issue dating back 20 years, and we've seen the evolution of acceptance of gays in society, and then beyond that, gay athletes. I mean, there has been an evolution, and we have observed that evolution, and yet here we are, and I'm saying 20 years later, and we're still waiting for that first high-profile major team professional athlete to come out while he's still playing. And in the past, I've and I don't know whether it was with you, but with others, I've talked about, it's almost the Jackie Robinson syndrome. I can't help but, 20 years ago, that first gay athlete would have faced every bit of the kind of scrutiny and the difficulty that a Jackie Robinson faced when he broke the color barrier in Major League Baseball. Do you honestly believe he or she would face that today?
Of course not.
Then why?
He came out of the closet. He is a great example. Let me just show you why I know that's not the case. When John Amici came out of the closet 3 years ago, he's a former NBA player. Article after article, commentator after commentator, across the board, from the Washington Post, the New York Times, ESPN, Sports Illustrated, every single one was positive. What courage, what a great story, so glad he did it, so glad he can be himself. A week later, Tim Hardaway said, I hate gay people. He was fired by the NBA, he was fired by the CBA, his coaching job, and he became a pariah. And those two things that happened within a week of each other tell you that the society is not okay with people being anti-gay, and they are okay with people being gay. But again, the reason we don't have that first person is two reasons. First of all, it's like walking in your backyard in the middle of the night. You don't know what's out there. You get a little nervous. Your heart starts to race a little bit. Maybe there's a big monster there to get you. But if you walk out there in the middle of the day, there's no problem.
Mm.
Because nobody's done it, nobody knows. It's like walking into your backyard in the dark. You don't know what's going to happen, no matter what the evidence. How many times have you seen your backyard with no monsters in it? For some reason, when it gets dark, you think it's monsters. The other thing is that, like I said before, the media continues to portray the sports world as homophobic. They continue to showcase these athletes like Tim Hardaway, like John Rocker, who say these horribly homophobic things, instead of focusing on LeBron James, who said, if I have a gay teammate, I hope he comes out of the closet. But nobody talks about that. They focus on the negative and how horrible it would be. So no wonder that all these athletes think that would be a horrible thing, because they have the media constantly telling them they can't do it.
Does the gay community hope that an athlete comes out while he's still active? I mean, is this a point of discussion?
Of course. I mean, it's like, you know, it would be a real source of pride. As long as he's a good player, it would be a source of pride. If he was a bad player and choked a big game away, maybe not. But on the flip side, every single person who comes out of the closet, virtually without exception, says it's a positive experience and they're glad they did. So for that alone, for the own person's own health, I wish they would.
Yeah. I mean, does it become, is it the search for a standard bearer? I'm struggling with the right words here, the right description. But I mean, Jackie Robinson, again, to use that comparison, became an icon for African Americans, and certainly for African American athletes.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, even though we know there are many gay athletes, even though we know that now more than a few have come out immediately after their careers, is it still important, I guess, is what I'm trying to say?
Of course it is. Of course it is. Because, you know, no matter what percentage, first of all, no matter what percentage of people say they have no problem with a gay player, there are still many people who don't believe that gay people can play sports. It's insane, but people still think that a gay person, well, if they play a sport, it must be swimming or figure skating. And maybe there's a higher percentage of gay people in those sports, I don't know. But there is still a stereotype, a very strong stereotype, that gay people can't play sports, that gay people aren't strong, they're not masculine. And so absolutely, the UK has this. Gareth Thomas is an active player. He's one of the greatest rugby players of all time,
right,
in the UK. And he's now openly gay. He's one of the most feared players in the whole league, and he's now openly gay. The UK has that player that the North America still is waiting for.
The former Welsh rugby captain, in fact, Gareth Thomas. And I don't know. Yeah. I don't know enough about the response. Maybe you can tell the audience. I mean, what has the reaction in general been in both Wales and in Great Britain in general, as you understand it?
Well, from what I understand, from just hearing interview after interview of Gareth and reading things in the newspapers over there, it's been overwhelmingly positive. Again, this guy was the fiercest. He was the most feared player in the whole league. His teammates were incredibly supportive. And you know what the great thing about it is? The teammates are talking about how they tease him about it, which is awesome. It means that it's an issue that they feel comfortable with, and he's still a part of the team. And of course, good-natured teasing is a part of being on a team. So they still consider him an equal member of the team. And the issue is in off-limits in the locker room, which I think is great. It's a positive thing.
Yeah. 90 seconds here, Sid, so we got to be quick here. Are you surprised that an athlete hasn't come out? And I don't think I've asked you that specific question. And I ask it in this respect, that in any part of society, in any walk of life, there will be those of great self-confidence and bravado. I have no reason to believe that it's any different with gay athletes. And so it seems to me that I'm surprised that somewhere along the line there hasn't been that one guy who says, you know what, screw everybody else, I don't care, I'm going to come out. Are you surprised that hasn't happened? I'm shocked.
I am. Given the nature of athletes, I'm surprised somebody just hasn't said enough is enough. I want to live my life and leave me alone. I'm actually quite surprised. If you asked me 10 years ago this question, I would have said there was a 1% chance that in 10 years no one would come out. But that 1% chance happened.
Yeah. I share that assessment. And here we are, 20 years later, still waiting. And hopefully we'll live long enough to see it. Because
it's got to happen at some point.
Well, you think so, but I would have thought it would have happened by now. Hey, listen, it's good of you to take time for us. We appreciate it. I know you're running for a train there, so we'll talk to you down the road. Thank you.
No problem. Thank you.
Sid Ziegler of Outsports.com. Still ahead, John Shannon will join us in studio. Kevin McGrann of The Star, Bob Elliott of The Sun, Jared Bell from USA Today, Wayne Parrish now of Post Media Network, and Keith Law of ESPN. All when Primetime Sports continues. This is The Fan Toronto.